All right, so let me take a minute and tell you about Avik. Avik is a SaaS application. It's for small and medium-sized businesses, and it is a network management tool. The whole idea is it makes it easier to build and manage an IT network. Okay, so Avik's first level of functionality they called SEEC, and the idea is that it focuses on network visibility. So unlike some of the network management tools you get from, you know, really big providers that are selling you massive pieces of network management software, Avik takes only 5 minutes to install. All you do, download a virtual appliance to your network, and then give it permission to discover your environment. Off you go. And when it's doing that, what's going on is it's going to map your entire network and then capture the profile and configuration of every device, assuming you've authorized it to do that. With that information, it can then track those configs over time and automatically back them up every time there's a change, and then it keeps a log of every version. So let's say you want to go back and revert to an earlier config that you had on that device. You've got a one button restore that's got you covered to do that. So like any network management platform, Avik's got a lot of other useful information, helpful usage, performance stats. It pulls your network every 30 seconds, gathering data. And all of that, of course, gives you the insights you need to troubleshoot quickly and plan effectively. Look ahead. What's byte bandwidth utilization? What are the statistics on this device? Do I need to do something different for next year? You've got all the information you need to do those kind of things. And you can do that looking at high level graphs, give you a general idea of what's going on, or you can drill right down into the details and get just as nitty gritty as you want. And also, kind of interesting, you can cross-reference the stats to your configuration history, and that way you can correlate, hey, did this change we made somehow impact network performance and what's going through it? Sound interesting? I hope so. If you like the sound of what you hear about Avik, you can go up to avik.com/pp. That is AUVIK.com/pp, short for packet pushers, and get more info there. And of course, you can try the product out absolutely free.
This is Greg Farrell. I'm at a conference today called Powering the Cloud. Not sure quite what that means, because the cloud doesn't normally need power, just lots and lots of money. But hey, we're at an event. Joining me today is Martin Glassborough. Please tell people about yourself.
Hi, I'm Martin Glassborough. I write as StorageBot for Register and also blog at www.storagebot.com.
And also with us today is Chris.
Yeah, hi, Chris Evans. I'm on Twitter as Chris M. Evans. I'm a consultant, bit of a writer occasionally, and online at architecting.it.
Fantastic. Right. So what we wanted to do today was have a bit of a storage admin versus network admin bitch fest slap, kissy kissy, lovey lovey, hate hate.
Absolutely.
And yeah, probably come to the final realization that we're both all screwed as technology interests. Is that about right? I think we were sort of in the bar last night talking about the future of storage, and then realized that networking's probably got exactly the same challenges at the end of the day.
Well, if you're a storage guy and your job is purely storage and that's all you do, you really don't have a future, I don't think, because your tasks will be subsumed either into a converged platform, or it'll be integrated into an API, and then somebody else will just do that bit of work for you. Mm-hmm. So somebody will set the box up, somebody will configure it, and then job done.
Yeah.
Goodbye, storage admins.
These hyper-converged platforms like Nutanix and Simplivity, or even VCE.
But even something like, say, SolidFire, where you just plug in a new server when you need more capacity or performance. It's got an API. It's all API-driven. It integrates up into things like CloudStack and OpenStack and so on. It's got a GUI. You set quality of service on everything. Job done.
Job done.
Yep.
Like the old stuff about short-stroking disks and...
There's no disk. It's all flash. Exactly. So it's all large-scale, large-size flash. No disk, no overhead to even think about. Great.
So as a networking guy who loathes storage people, this is like a moment of great rejoicing. There shall be no more storage people.
All your Christmases have come at once, Greg, haven't they?
Well, it's always the storage admin with Fibre Channel who drives me bat insane.
Why do we drive you mad with Fibre Channel? It's none of your business. You're a network guy.
Yeah, but then you complain about how my Fibre Channel network's not accessible in all the places that I need it.
Yeah, but why are we talking to you at all? Storage teams manage SANs. We don't have networking people managing our SANs.
That's right, because they're so incompetent. They're just like
the networking people?
They're like serial cables, those Fibre Channel SANs, you know?
Well, it's just all static routes. That's what we understand. We're not very clever, most of us, so we don't understand that.
Oh, it just works, right?
Just works,
We just plug in and it just works. Is that right? Yeah.
I've got to say one thing on that. I actually did a bit of work somewhere where somebody had let the network team design the SAN.
Oh, that would be bad.
And it was bad.
Yeah.
Multiple layers of redundant ones, core and edge SANs that, you know, a bit like a network design. And I looked at it and went, well, we'll just take all of those switches out because they're absolutely redundant in that design.
Yeah, you can't use IP packet design for fiber channel design. They don't operate the same way. The protocols are... if you use packet design, like if you think of fiber channel as a packet technology, like frame technology, and you're going to switch the frames across the... That's not actually how SANs work. They work more like flows.
Yep.
Right? The A end talks to the B end, and that's it.
Point to point, yeah.
Yeah, it's point to point.
It might be across a switch. It might be...
It's more like an ATM circuit, actually.
Yeah, point to point.
And so you don't actually need to configure the network in any way like a normal Ethernet network. They don't run, think, act the same in any way.
Yep.
And so I could understand that. If somebody didn't know... or comprehend that the server application was very different.
And the other way around, you know, I'd probably look at the network and go, well, I only need a switch here and a switch there, and I'm done.
Why do I need three layers? Why is the core switch got... This makes no sense. Why am I...
Just have one big network that I can see every device
Big flat network. Right. Yeah,
that's... And what are all these funny protocols you're running? You only need one protocol.
Exactly.
But it's really important. The servers just can't live without their data, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, storage and the network, I mean, we are tightly bound.
Yeah.
Even if we hate each other, we're like some dysfunctional family. but we all love our kids for server team.
that's a special kind of love.
Yeah, no, they're our kids. They're like toddlers.
Toddlers, yeah.
Throwing their toys around the
precocious
place.
Precocious toddlers.
Making a mess of our nice environments.
Yeah, and they think they know what they're doing, but... Yeah, they're really just pooping their nappies most of the time.
Yeah, that's pretty much.
That would be good. You know, be good if the storage and the networking guys did actually team up against the server guys. That'd be pretty good. And the virtualization guys.
They wouldn't stand a chance.
Yeah. Well,
but you say about team up against the virtualization guys. I think it's more and more you can see storage guys and network guys becoming the virtualization guys.
Yeah.
Because virtualization from a server point of view is pretty straightforward.
Mm.
The difficult bit and the thing which you have to get right is your storage and your network. If you get that, if you get that wrong, your virtualization project is going to fail in a horrible, horrible way.
Mm.
I mean, how difficult is it to install an operating system? Not very difficult.
Just put the CD in the CD-ROM tray, don't you?
Yeah. Basically. So that's half of your audience gone. We've now upset the server guys.
Nobody's too upset about upsetting the server guys.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that I think, though, is that in networking, although there's still plenty of legs in the existing technology, like storage as well is going through the transition. It's moving away from arrays to distributed storage. And networking is moving away from this packet-by-packet, switch-by-switch to this flow SDN. Mm. And now we're seeing the rise of software-defined storage. Right, which is, and for me, the networking that's going on inside of the virtual machines and the networking that's going, like, you know, I just recorded a show with a guy who's got a fancy NIC, and he's got this NIC which has fundamentally got a computer on board, and he can actually start to do packet traces in the NIC and capture them at wire speed and spool them to a disk file. I mean, are those sorts of things coming to storage as well? Those sorts of inflections where once upon a time a network adapter was really just, you know, PCI bus Ethernet translator, and now they're actually full-on intelligence engines?
Well, people have done bits and pieces of things like that over the years. You know, some of the HBA vendors have tried to put other things in there. So they try to put in stuff that can split the data into two different directions, or they can cache it, you know, to a flash.
Fusion IO and those onboard flash cache
They're not really working the same way, to be honest, because they don't even use, a lot of them don't use directly use the storage protocols that an external device would use. Mm-hmm. So they're using their own drivers and so on. But I don't think that's really been something that's been that important, because if you look at the difference between, say, networking and storage in that sense up until, you know, until the SDX type stuff, networking's all been about the transient flow of stuff. Get it around where you want it to go to, but you don't hold on to it. You're getting it onto the next place. Storage has been more focused on storing it, retrieving it, making sure you can recover it, and less about the fact that you want to make sure it's available in lots of different places.
Yeah.
But I think with the storage-defined side of things, that's where it's changing. So now we're seeing people being more concerned about quality of service, more about availability. That's tied to a service level than the ability of a physical box to deliver that.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the commonality with SDN comes in as well.
SDN's got something very similar. It's like we don't just think about it packet by packet, we think about it flow by flow. Now we can do things like control flows at the edge of the network, where they come into the network, instead of before we used to, you know, ramp them towards a firewall to create a control point, because that was the only place. And visibility, we're now seeing new focuses on visibility of the flows. I want to be able to count not just packets, but flows and the application response time of those applications as they traverse the network, whether it's storage, you know, a database write or a high-frequency transaction or whatever it is. It's all, it's not just one thing. SDX is this whole transition to visibility, analytics, service or, you know, orientation, you know, faster agility, virtualizing the storage, virtualizing the network means being able to configure something without actually putting a new NIC in or, you know, not touching the physical part of the NIC. That virtualization part's really key.
Yeah, so the problem we have with SDS at the moment is, I mean, I think SDN's quite well defined. SDS, I mean, every vendor in the world has now jumped on the SDS bandwagon.
Let me assure you that every vendor in the world has jumped on the SDN bandwagon. That is exactly the same in our industry.
And it's meaning so, it's changing its meaning depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
So we got our friends at NetApp who talk about being the biggest SDS platform in the world, and they talk about ONTAP. Really? Well, that's not really what an SDS platform is.
Yep.
But everybody's leaping on it. We get the confused hodgepodge of products from EMC. See, I got that in. Hodgepodge, guys.
It's a good word.
It's a great word, hodgepodge. Yeah. Did you hot potch or hodgepodge?
Hodgepodge.
Yep.
Yeah. So the major vendors are all trying to leap on this bandwagon,
but
with no real thought about what it really means.
Hmm.
Does it mean doing things with scripts programmatically, APIs?
Is it hardware abstraction?
Hardware abstraction. Is it just storage as software?
Is it storage abstraction? Is it hardware abstraction?
Yeah. I don't think anybody seems to know yet.
Yeah, there's some bits I think are quite clear that I would say you would expect. And it gets back to the fact that, as I just said, you're talking about the physical presence of data rather than it being transient through the network. So the ability to be consistent about the service level you give to an object, whether that's a LUN or a file or whatever that object happens to be, so that you can say, if I've got a box that's got 10 cores in it with tons of memory and all these sort of flash drives, it does the same level of performance to the user as a box twice as big.
Yep.
So that, you know, when I put that box in and I give that first guy his LUN and his performance, the guy who comes on at the very end doesn't get a different level of service to the guy who started, and the guy who started still gets the same level of service. And if I upgrade or I replace that technology at the hardware level, nothing changes.
And that's all manual today, right? The creation of those...
A lot of it's manual. And the reason I think a lot of it's manual historically is because hard drives were the slowest component.
Mm.
So your desire all the time was to get the I.O. back to the user as quickly as possible.
Yep.
You didn't try and slow it down because the hard drive was really slow.
Yep.
So everything else, you know, you wanted it just to happen really quickly. And a lot of the optimization that's gone on is all about improving the throughput to get that stuff back to the user as quickly as possible.
And there's always something you could do manually to get better performance.
Yeah. So, for instance, people have laid out the data differently, used different, you know, RAID 5 rather than RAID 6, where that might be an issue. They've put cache in the way. They've used caching algorithms that can understand how the disk spins and know when to stripe and read and destage data and prefetch.
Mm.
All sorts of different techniques, all focused at getting the I.O. completed and off that box back to the user as quickly as possible.
And that's exactly what's happening in networking, except it's exactly the same but different.
Mm.
So in networking, we've always had 10 meg, and that wasn't enough. And then it was 100 meg, and then it was 1 gig, and then it's 10 gig. And then as we went through each of those bandwidths, the devices weren't fast enough. They couldn't switch non-blocking at wire speed on all the ports, and now all of a sudden you've got SSDs, which changes everything because there's more performance in a flash array than you can possibly use.
Yeah,
and so now it's no longer about, you know, twiddling thumbs and, you know, checking that all the hairs are lined up in the right direction and fiddling. Now it's just about turn it into a service.
Yeah,
I have a big thing about post scarcity economics. Right, the whole IT industry is moving from what was once a scarce. Mm. You know, we never had enough bandwidth, we never had enough storage, we never had enough network speed, we never had enough storage capacity, we never had fast enough CPUs, we never have enough memory. And now we've got a manufacturing base where we have cheap CPUs, plenty of memory, the network bandwidth is faster than the servers, and we've got flash storage combined with disks to give us all the performance and all the storage we've ever needed, really, at, you know, reasonably, you know, depending on who you buy it from.
Yeah.
If we went with an EMC hodgepodge or a NetApp, you know, agglomeration.
That's the stellar R12 of the market, isn't it? You know, reassuringly expensive.
Yeah.
And if you've drunk Stella, you'd know that you know, you weren't necessarily buying the...
Yeah, but, you know, Stellas, they use a lot of horses when they make Stella Artois, I thought.
Yes.
Yeah, because they have to shoot them straight afterwards because they're that worn out. You know, time they... I won't willingly drink Stella.
I think anybody does. Oh,
so we're going to force Greg later to drink Stella.
Yes. Maybe German Stella is different, but I doubt it.
Purity laws, they probably can't sell Stella here.
They probably can't, I would imagine.
Because
they've
got
purity.
Horses in it or something.
Well, the thing is, we've got Hansi in there, so that any decision about what beer we drink is now completely decided, because it'll always be Belgian, and Belgian is the only good beer. Yeah. So we'll have to drink Belgian beer, and Hans will be in charge.
As long as he's paying for it.
As long as, well, yes, that's right. Or a very generous vendor might send it. We could hope.
A suitable credit card with vendor attached.
That would be excellent. We love vendors like that.
Yeah. Vendors, credit cards with vendors attached, we should have more of those.
Especially if said vendor sits in the corner, doesn't say anything, and just...
Even better.
Yeah, we'll remember them.
Yeah,
well, sometimes.
We don't really want to talk about that product.
No.
So getting back to what we were talking about, you are right. You know, we've got an abundance of resources to be able to deliver that. So
do you agree with that shift, what I just said about the post-scarcity?
We are in that scenario, yeah, absolutely. And we definitely were with, in the storage array, it was scarcity of IOPS. Mm. You know, as people always say, capacity was cheap. IOPS cost money. So, you know, it cost money to put in more expensive disk.
Yeah.
And that's why tiering came in, simply because we all would have just had all our stuff on tier one, raid one, really expensive stuff if it wasn't, you know, if cost wasn't an issue, but it is.
Yeah.
And even that didn't deliver the number of IOPS we wanted, and that's why all the optimization techniques came in to try and get around the issues with that device. Well, we're not in that position anymore, so
but
now
things
we can
like
deliver
in storage, we have the optimization technology, you know, like the dedupe, as you write. That used to be a magic feature that, like, as the CPUs have gotten bigger and bigger, more and people have shifted to Intel x86, everybody does dedupe in the array now.
Yeah.
It used to be a feature that only certain people had. Now everybody's got it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Some of them are better than others, arguably. But
well, this is where features, products become features. So if you look at a lot of things like the data domain, which are dedupe appliances, these are just really features now. We're seeing this. And I think we may all be seeing it again as well, where some storage companies are trying to sell performance as a product. No, performance is a feature.
Mm.
And I suspect it's probably very true in the networking environment as well.
Yeah. It very much so. So, you know, if you can do 40 gig, and it's a little bit more commoditized in networking, right? 40 gig or 100 gig Ethernet is kind of, you know, the data center is commonplace, right? It's what is a product now in networking, even making switches is cheap because the commodity silicon, so you can go for low cost, you know, white box switches if you choose, or you can go with branded stuff, which is supposedly of better quality or is high quality software. Despite the fact that we get bugs pretty much in equal numbers from either platform, and they get solved. Admittedly, the white box stuff doesn't get solved as fast as the vendor stuff, but, you know, considering the price you pay, you might expect that.
So would you say, for instance, a firewall product originally, really not just a feature? If you're going to do it in software, would it not just...
It's now a bug.
It's becoming a bug. And I think, so what we're seeing with firewalls is true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's now becoming a feature as part of the network, because it'll actually happen in the virtual switch.
Yeah.
So we're seeing with like VMware's NSX product, they'll actually do the filtering right at the edge of the network. We don't need a stateful firewall if you're blocking at source, right? So if you know that this server shouldn't talk to that server, and if you block it at source, you don't need to statefully inspect it because the metadata that's attached to it. So because the VMware platform knows the metadata of the server, you can block this. You can say any server starting with the letter V can't talk to any server starting with the letter W.
So it never even gets to come out.
So you don't need to have a rule in your firewall that blocks it. So
there you go. I think that's what you're saying, Martin. Yeah. And obviously your reference there is to Flash. And, you know, we know that when the vendors came out with Flash products, they were selling it as a product, thinking that it was a category in its own right, which, you know, it isn't. It's just a feature of the way you deliver the I.O. to the user.
Yeah, but I think the flip side is, for networking, we're turning connectivity into services. So where once we were just lucky to be able to get servers connected to the network and storage connected to the network, and everybody would congratulate themselves when the plugging in was all done and it was all turned on, nowadays that's the least we can do, and now we've got to be able to provision monitoring, visibility. And then once you've got visibility, you want analytics to do mass analysis of those systems, or you want new ways of reporting the system, and to combine the logged data with the virtualization data, with the storage data, so that you can say this storage engine's running slow because the network says it's slow. I can see the application slow, therefore everything's dead, right? So, instead of us all sitting around the table going, it's not the network.
Well, perhaps, you know, in certain circumstances, there might have been a lot of disagreements between the networking guys and the storage guys because we didn't have the visualization. So we looked at our stuff and went, ours is all right. You looked at your stuff and went, well, mine's all right.
Can't see any problems in the network.
And to a certain degree, to have a go at Fibre Channel and to get a mainframe plug-in, in the mainframe days, you had end-to-end visibility of an I.O. You actually knew when it left the device and went to the storage and back again. You had a breakdown of everything, every single piece of the latency. So you could see whether that was the spinning of the disk that was causing it or some other component. Fibre Channel is less transparent because the exchange of the packet doesn't contain all that data.
No.
So if something has to happen, like the array has to replicate, that latency doesn't get shown in the I.O. from that.
There's no feedback loop back to the source.
There's no connection. So what you see is half-hearted attempts to try and tie the two up, where you see a device that might actually monitor the I.O. going back and forth, and then somewhere else where you're watching all the I.O.s going between the arrays. But you're not tying every single transaction up with each other. You're looking at bigger numbers. You're looking at averages and stuff like that to try and give you an idea. And that isn't really always a great one to see, because it could be one little piece that's broken.
But the thing was, in the old days, when we did those old days, when we did this mainframe stuff that we were talking about, every device in the network had to hold state. In the storage network, had to hold state about the performance to be able to gather that information.
Yeah.
And again, that meant a lot of extra hardware and a lot of cost.
And that was still the case when we moved to having to be able to do that, or being able to do that in, say, Fibre Channel networks, where the cost of putting in infrastructure to monitor what was there was ridiculously expensive.
Yep.
There are companies still selling that sort of technology.
And we chose not to.
Well, we
customers
chose not
talk
to.
With their wallets and say we aren't paying for it.
Yeah, we chose not to because most of the time Fibre Channel was so reliable it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And people didn't have the skills to debug what actually came out of things like analyzers when it went wrong.
Well, we were talking about this last night. The fact is that as storage has become much more simple, and the death of the storage admin, there are going to be less and less people who actually understand the protocols or anything to do with it. So the number of storage admins who will be able to talk about what a floggy is and how a device logs into the SAN will be ever shrinking. Now, is that important? Probably not important 99% of the time, but 1% of the time, when you've got something weird going on, it may well be important.
It may.
But these people are going to die. So, like mainframe.
Like, literally, they're old like us.
Yeah. They'll retire, they'll be out of the business, they won't be around.
It's only 10 years until we're out.
Yeah, that's it.
Or I'll be retired into management, one of the two.
Or on a beach, or, writing, or
if I retired in management, I'd probably want to be dead from the neck up anyway.
I don't think that would be your best route.
Oh, I can see Greg as a mentor for many people.
I can just see, I'm just wondering how that would work in management.
Don't you think so?
Well,
I think I could be a Leela's feeder.
People wouldn't be worried about what they'd be pretty clear on what the message was, wouldn't they? Put it that way.
How do you think my vendor negotiation skills would be?
Excellent, in fact. Because that's the way you need to treat vendors. You need to be very clear with what you're after and what you're prepared to pay.
Yeah.
Don't mess it up.
You need to let them know exactly what you're expecting and give them an opportunity to give their feedback as to what's actually possible.
Absolutely.
I like to dream the impossible myself and expect very little from the vendors.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
Well, then you'll never be disappointed. That's quite easy.
I learned that from you, Martin, I think. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Martin's the expert at upsetting vendors, aren't you, Martin?
I try not to. I never intend to upset vendors. I treat them all equally. I'm equally nice to all of them.
Well, okay. We'd have to work out where the scale sits in terms of what nice means in that.
Yeah, I was going to say nice is a very abused word, I think we've just seen a very excellent example there. Very
absolutely.
Good. So one of the other things we were talking about last night or today, we were talking about how networking and storage in particular are very capital-intensive businesses. Right? And I was saying I think that we need to see more of a shift away from spending more money on the next big thing, rushing off and buying the next big array, rushing off and buying the next big switch and putting it in the network because that's going to fix all of our problems. And that we should be using more people to maximize the usage, like the utilization. Do you think, if I made a statement like this, right, if we could employ more people in the IT team, could we utilize our assets better? Could we increase the average utilization of our storage arrays and our networks?
Yes, I think we probably could. the environments are getting so large, but you're spending all your time maintaining them as opposed to improving them and making them better. So you need more people. You need people to keep the lights on, and you need other people to work out how you're going to make those lights shine a bit brighter,
yep,
or run a bit more efficiently. And that, I think that's what the problem we have. We are cutting teams right back down to the bone. And I'm going to blame vendors for this.
Mm.
Vendors keep making this thing, if you do this, you can get rid of people.
Yeah, if you only spent a couple of million with us,
yeah,
you could get rid of two headcount.
Yeah.
Well, we repurpose, don't we? We never really get rid of people we describe it as repurposing, but no, what we mean is we get rid of people.
But we do, right? I've been doing a lot of advisory with CIOs and, you know, heads of operations, and talking to them about how they could, you know, they've got problems in the network. And you sit down and spend a few days working with their teams, and these people are firefighters. But they, unlike firefighters, they're not doing fire prevention. So your average firefighting, you know, the firehouse where all of the firemen live when they're not fighting fires, they're usually going around schools teaching kids fire prevention and checking out fire escapes and making sure that, you know, the safety routes are all in place, yeah, and that, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's called fire prevention. So when the time comes to fight fire, when a fire actually happens, it's the shortest possible time and the minimum time to recover, right? Whereas most IT teams I'm looking at spend all their time going from this fire to this fire to this, and sometimes they're actually calculating which fire they're going to fight next. While this one's, you know, while this problem in the net is here, and this problem, and I just think that until we get to fire prevention, and I mean this is where software-defined networking and software-defined storage comes in, visibility, analytics, you know, virtualization means we can make changes that aren't in the live infrastructure and stuff. But we have to have fire prevention, time and resources to go and do fire prevention to make that happen. Is that?
Yeah, I think we do. And I think you need a variety of skills. So you need the people who can just do stuff. You know, guy's going to come in, just be there, deploy, whatever they do.
Replacing disks, yeah, patching power cables.
All that sort of stuff. Mm. But you need somebody who can see the big picture. So somebody who understands the implications of design and how you should design things, how you should lay things out, how you should structure things. Because getting that wrong is probably one of the things that leads to more of the problems you see later down the line.
So I've seen a lot of companies rely on vendors to do design. And that seems false to me, because the vendor's interest in designing something for you is to maximize how much revenue they can take from you, surely.
And I've seen designs that look absolutely awful. And you look at it and think, well, why was that designed like that? And you can see it was done because the vendor was trying to push a message of whether it was performance, whether it was, you know, whatever it happens to be. I actually was involved in...
Or setting a five-year strategy for revenue for himself.
Well, probably more likely. But
if you buy this product, it has to have this management product, which needs this expensive, you know.
Well, there are very good examples of that. But something, yeah, going back a while back for a company that's now defunct, but was a large investment company,
yeah,
they were spending an absolute fortune building a DMX to run Exchange. And they had to lay it out a certain way. They weren't using the outside, the slower parts of the physical disk, all these sort of things that they were doing to maximize the performance. And then... because they were selling that component, they weren't selling the fiber channel part, the fabric part. They didn't look at that. So they had hosts with 1 gig HPAs when they should have had two. But none of that actually affected the performance, because it was so massively over-engineered in the first place,
yep,
by the vendor, that all of those things weren't relevant.
And so they just had all this money.
So they were spending a fortune on stuff they didn't need to spend.
Yeah.
But that's because they relied on the vendor to help them design it.
I've seen that so many times. It's like, in networking, we have the core switch, and people buy these monster core switches that just have vast amounts of capacity, because the core switch is going to be there for a decade. But, you know, and they'll spend millions buying this particular unit, and then you could have done it with smaller units, and if with a little bit of effort and a professional services, you could just rotate them halfway and cut 40 or 50% from the cost.
Absolutely. I had another one where... Another large banking organization, somebody had come up with a design where this is Cisco MDS switches at the time, fiber channel, and they built a core edge core architecture where there was a core MDS and there were edge MDSs for hosts and edge MDSs for storage.
Mm.
And that's what they were dedicated to. So there were MDS switches that were doing nothing but switching between the two layers.
Mm.
And of course, that's not the way that the fiber channel protocol was designed.
No.
The ones in the middle just melted. They couldn't cope with having to look at all the traffic and decide where to route it to.
Yeah, because the fiber channel switches have to hold state. And
yeah, it was a crazy design. And you looked at it and thought, well, we can take out a whole layer of this and save £1 million worth of fiber channel ports in that one fabric.
Yep.
but no, it went ahead. Still went ahead.
It's like,
you want to just, sometimes you don't want to, you know, hit your head off a wall, hit somebody else's head off a wall.
Yeah. And that's where you get to say, I told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except it's never sweet.
It's too late then.
It's too late by then, because they forget. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Never really works. And a sponsor for the packet pushers today is NetRounds. Now, you would have heard of NetRounds already, but NetRounds solves your need to quickly measure network and service quality from an end-user perspective. What it does is by putting probes into the network, it collects data, summarizes it, and then it exports it to their SaaS or cloud application for analysis. This makes sure that your network meets the quality standards and helps you find and fix really quite difficult problems, because packet capture is one of the best ways. But the problem with packet capture, of course, is that there's an awful lot of data, and finding the patterns is really difficult to find the underlying cause. So using this SaaS-based solution gives you really good experience monitoring for the user and has built-in tools for quick troubleshooting using real-world traffic generation methodologies. It can even generate traffic as well. So through a user-friendly web GUI, NetRounds can bring you historic network visibility because they save all the data and store it for you so you can see back into the past as well as what's happening now, which can help you improve quality and reduce the troubleshooting time. NetRounds is really easy to use. It's offered as an affordable monthly subscription. You can sign up for a free entry edition and download two traffic generators, which run as virtual machines, or on just your own hardware. Get a couple of spare servers and drop them in the network, and then you'll get access to the whole suite of tools, IPv6, VoIP, HTTP, DNS, and so much more. Just head over to netrounds.com and create your own account, and you could get started today. We thank NetRounds for sponsoring the Packet Pushers.
So, are we going to talk about why storage and network teams hate each other?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we do.
Yeah, we probably do.
Well, the hardest part about dealing with storage people, right, is that they're always, like, backward. It's always like, we need to do something just a little bit progressive here. And the storage team say, what about backups? What if it doesn't work? What if it's not, you know...
That's because we look after the company's most important asset, its data. If we lose it, we're screwed, and you're screwed as well. So we're looking after you, Greg.
Why doesn't your technology do a better job of that?
Well, hold on a second. Let's just have a go at the network guys for a second, because the network guys, really what they're doing is they're just passing the buck. All they do is they see this thing come in, they go, oh, get rid of it.
Yep.
You know, they take it in, they throw it out. They don't care if they send it to the right person.
We don't even care if it loses a packet or two
absolutely.
Or three. We can lose 5% of the packets.
If you throw it away and it goes to the wrong guy.
It's clever, cares? Right?
Mm. Well, it is.
It's clever because, you know, we designed the networks that way, knowing that that's how they're going to work.
Well, that's fine when you don't really care
about
it.
It's a bit different from sort of sticking your fingers in and you go, no, never going to drop a packet. Let me pretend I'm never going to drop. No, the data's never going to get corrupted. I don't have to panic.
Well,
So one of my standard interview questions when I'm interviewing new storage admins is, okay, all your backups have failed overnight. What do you do? And the correct answer is you phone up a network team and ask which idiot actually changed the firewall configuration.
What if you don't have a firewall?
You blame some other part of the network.
Because it's always a network problem when your backups fail.
Well, I always sit there and say, well, why don't you just get your tapes back from Iron Mountain?
Have you ever tried to get tapes back from Iron Mountain?
That's not my problem. That's your fault. That's the thing is, it's definitely not my problem when it's in tape.
Yeah, but that's the best form of network.
Yeah.
It's called a road with a van.
I don't think we'll ever get to a position where we actually see eye to eye. I think
the thing that really bothers me about storage as a general industry, you know, present company excluded perhaps, is that the storage people are really not willing as a general rule to take it to change, like distributed storage. Like in this event, all we hear about is distributed storage vendors, you know, like Datacore, Zadara, Nutanix, you know, all these companies producing these distributed storage engines. And every time I meet with a storage person working for a big enterprise and say, you know, you should be talking about big distributed storage systems as an alternative array tech, you know, storage technology, you'd swear that the devil just rose up out of the floor and started flapping his wings and there's sulfurous clouds of, you know, and evil incarnate, because they say distributed storage doesn't work, it's failed. You know, just stupid stuff, just ridiculous, stupid stuff.
Well, maybe we have to take a step back and wonder whether... we've been indoctrinated too much by our vendors into thinking in a certain way.
Yeah.
And as a result, there's a certain degree of inability in organizations to actually be flexible and look at things and say, yeah, let's try something. Let's just put in on one environment something slightly different and see how it works. Let's build it out. You know, let's look at whether that's even practical.
So this is what I say to them. I say, why don't you build a dual mode infrastructure? Right? Over here is your blessed HP's, you know, Dell, IBM, Cisco servers with their magic powers and fairy wings on them and all that sort of stuff. And here's your magic arrays from EMC and NetApp with all that, you know, and there's millions of dollars trapped inside of that. And they're probably barely turning over. But build another one over here that uses all the new stuff, uses all the different, and then try it out.
And I've seen people do that. I've seen some good examples where people have, I wouldn't call it skunk works because that's not very fair, but they've gone off and thought, right, let's just find a different way to solve this problem. And a good example would be something like Atlantis Computing have got a bit of software that effectively caches VDI data, or their older product was for VDI, and it caches, dedupes that data in memory.
Yep.
So you can actually run your entire VDI solution on JBODs. You don't have to go and buy expensive disk. You can just buy a server with JBODs in and use the software to do the clever stuff.
Put a lot of memory in and...
Yeah, and you've got lots of other people who are trying to sell you massive flash arrays to handle that problem, and it's the wrong approach. But, you know, the big vendor who's got the marketing dollars who comes along with, you know, something that you'll be happy to sign because he'll sign up to it and say, you know, if it doesn't work,
the most expensive product can afford the most salespeople. Mm. And so they're the people out there telling you that you should buy their product. So if you listen to the salespeople, you might not be hearing about the best solution for something because the cheaper solution just doesn't have the salespeople on the street.
But we are beginning to see that change, some of the major vendors. As the larger vendors begin to realize that life changes for them, distributed storage is a thing.
Mm.
And as they start having products, they're starting to tell people about them. And for whatever reason, the storage admin will start to admit that this is a product and it's something we should do.
We've got the same problem in networking. Networking's going from this tree, you know, this core distribution edge thing, right? And we're seeing the rise of ECMP, equal cost, it's a two-layered multipath and all that sort of thing. And there's a number of people that I'll talk to about that, and they'll do me the distributed storage thing of, oh, well, you know, it's not proven yet, you know, it's still early days, we wouldn't want to move to the new, and you're just sitting there going like, oh my God, but at least conceptually, I see that less often than I do in storage people who get all huffy about Fibre Channel and being the only true network or something.
Yeah, what I am beginning to see is companies all have their traditional model, which they're running their legacy workloads, and as they start moving towards what people are calling the third platform, that will be a distributed storage, and there's a lot more discussion about how that will work. So the legacy model will be there. It's probably not going to grow massively, but the distributed storage model, which will be your parallel track, will grow, and it will grow massively. So there's an acceptance. I've seen cases recently where people have tried to stick third platform type products on top of legacy architectures. It's a really bad idea. Yeah. Don't do it. It will just cause you pain. But then again, we'll see people talking about Hadoop and moving away from the Hadoop distributed storage and then sticking them on arrays. And actually, there are cases where that might work slightly better.
Everything's a use case, right?
Yeah.
Every technology in the world has a use case. The question is it the right one for you? This comes back to this, we need more people to make smarter decisions. You shouldn't go and buy vendor X because you're already buying vendor X. You really need to make sure that their use case works for your use case.
And certainly in storage, what we're seeing is we're beginning to see general purpose arrays become less important. We're now putting in storage silos into our data center. We're doing this quite a lot now, so you're thinking, actually, that piece of storage is really fast, I need it for that. That storage is really lots of capacity, I can use it for that. And it's for protocols and the applications on top, which is moving the data around. So we're provisioning pools of storage for applications to use, and then we move on to the next silo, and then we move on to the next silo. So we're pushing the intelligence up. We want the intelligence to be run by the developers and the applications. Yep. We just want to worry about provisioning services which they can use.
And so from a networking perspective, to take that, what's happening now for me is that I can't use those tree network architectures that we talked about because the performance of those really blows, because everything has to go up to the core to come back down. If you're going to start having storage silos and you're using Ethernet and IP to do them, if you go east-west, the performance isn't there. So you have to have these ECMP networks for distributed storage. And there's going to be, and in fact, I'm seeing distributed storage projects drive ECMP network sales.
Oh, they will do.
Yeah. Because you're just moving so much data around, and you've got such... Yeah, and they're tolerant to loss, and they're...
There's a lot more discussion about that east-west traffic now with storage guys, and if you're not aware that you need to be thinking about east-west traffic and you're working storage, well, you do need to know this, and you need to understand this impact, and you need to understand what distributed storage is going to do to your network team.
Yeah, so,
you know, we shouldn't be precious about the idea of Fibre Channel, particularly.
Yeah.
We've gone through a cycle. The cycle was... It was a mess when it was all distributed in separate servers, and it was really difficult to manage. And, you know, individual servers had to have devices pulled. It was a lot of overhead. Centralization and Fibre Channel fixed a lot of those problems. Now we're in a different set of problems.
Yeah.
So now we should accept that. We shouldn't think that that's now going to fix all the next set of problems. Mm. Let's move on. Let's accept that, as Martin said, that Fibre Channel will still exist for some parts of the work.
Yep.
And look at the right application, the right feature, the right product to fix the other parts that we need to move on with. Simple as that.
It depends.
Mm.
Yeah, you're always going to have legacy framed Fibre Channel for years and years to come.
Yeah.
And it's going to be connected to this, you know, this array concepts, because that's what they work best at, and there's no point in... re-enabling those for the next generation. And then there's going to be these distributed storage systems which do act differently, work differently, but are very network intensive.
But it's a very interesting time to be in storage, and probably in networking as well, because we're seeing things where I will argue quite strongly that the enterprise array is done. It's nearly done. There's nothing more you want to do in it. So it almost becomes, if you bubble wrap it, we know how that works, we can deploy that at will, we know how it works. So now we're moving to a different paradigm.
It's a bit like your Windows 2003 server or 2008 server. You know how it works. You've got your deployments.
Yeah.
You've got your scripts. Bag it, tag it, move on to the next thing.
Yeah. So we're now looking at how things are changing. So we're looking... And there's a market shake-up to come. We know there's something going to happen. We know there'll be unlikely mergers. We'll see technologies die. We may be wrong about...
Which one?
Which one, yeah.
But we're paid to take gambles or make bets or select... products and vendors and stuff.
I would say, actually, if I had any advice to anybody who was ever going to move into IT architecture, be prepared to be wrong a lot.
Yeah.
It is your job to be wrong.
Especially if you work in networking.
And if it's your, if you're in storage, it's not your job to be wrong, it's just your job to do nothing. Just sit around and say no to everything.
The team that likes to say no.
But I think the other thing about... We were talking about this last night, right? The thing about being an architect is that the and to some extent even being a blogger or an influencer or a writer or whatever it is that we are these days, right, is that the vendors go around telling you how awesome everything is, and they're very good at telling you their values and what it is about their product that's got value to you and the use cases where the value is worthwhile. And if sometimes we come across a little cynical or a little bitter or, you know, showing... The negative sides of the vendor story is because that's what your job as a network architect or an engineer is to see the things that are wrong and make sure you don't design the bad things in.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to see the bad stuff, pick out the things that are going to be bad for your use case, and design around them. And so that's why when I'm writing or talking a lot of times, I'm highlighting it doesn't have this feature or it doesn't have this thing or it doesn't do that very well. I'm not criticizing the vendor. I'm looking for that because I'm trained to. That's my job for the customers, to make sure the customer doesn't implement the bad thing. Fair?
It's totally fair. And, you know, you're right. It could come across that a lot of what gets written could be seen as always negative.
Mm.
But, you know, who else is going to write that fair balance? The vendor's not going to turn around and say, oh, by the way, here's all the things that are wrong with my products, are they? They're never going to give you that list up front.
Yeah.
You know, you find that out by questioning, by trialing it, by looking at it, by... looking at references, by talking to other customers, by talking to people who are in the industry who understand this sort of stuff, like you said, like, you know, like us sitting around the table here. So, you know, the other thing I'd say is that look at some of the stuff that we do, right? When there's positive stuff to be said, I'll be positive, you know.
Yep.
But, I'm not going to talk about something and not be honest about what might be an issue with something.
Yeah, I mean, that's honesty. That's what you'd expect from the bloggers.
Yeah.
And it's a great time in some ways for us to be working in IT architecture.
Yeah.
Because we all know each other, but it's actually fairly easy for somebody else to get to know us. The social media side of things means that we will talk. So.
I think that's another thing too, is the industry's changing because the internet means we talk.
Yeah.
Right? Where in years gone by, your company and my company and, you know, your employer would be competitors or, you know, whatever, and we wouldn't have an outlet to talk. Mm. unless it was at a conference. And even then, I still go to conferences and people don't want to tell me who they work for, or they won't talk about their site. Or, but that's increasingly rare. We normally sit there and say, oh, yeah, I bought that thing and it's rubbish. Yeah. And here's what went wrong and it was this and this. And you're like, right, remember that, remember that, remember that. The internet's breaking. And social media, people get on Twitter and say just, you know, for example, I've been running iOS 8.1 for a week, and go out and you say, iOS 8.1's working for me. Well, that's not a validation for the next, for 10 million people that iOS 8.1 actually works, but it's a good data point to know, you know. Or I've got Yosemite running on this laptop, but I have to reboot every day just to be sure because I've got memory leaks and things in certain apps. Well, that's worth knowing too, but I wouldn't know that in the old days because people wouldn't say.
No, I can remember when I supported, well, I'm going to get back and talk about the mainframe again because it's a great classic use case. When, you know, when we had to fix things, I'm sure Martin would remember, you'd go onto the IBM managed network and you'd look up things, and it would all be IBM's recorded lists of tickets of problems. It wouldn't be related necessarily to somebody like a customer who's writing it somewhere. It's IBM's list. And you'd look at that, and then maybe you'd have to order a fix. It'd be shipped on a tape. You know, so 3 weeks later, your problem, you might start to fix it. Whereas now, as you say, you use Google. And the good thing about things like Google and other search technologies is you can at least correlate the issues. So, for instance, you just said about the latest version of macOS. If you did a search and you saw hundreds of hits at the very top of that list going, oh, my God, I had this problem, it's done this, it's done this, you might back off a bit.
Yep.
But if you only see one guy who had a problem, you know, you can correlate that and say, well, actually, that's probably just that one guy, you know.
The internet's breaking down the sales model, I think. So in the old days, the only person you could get a lot of this information from was the sales and the pre-sales engineer, you know. And now, in a funny sort of way for me, it's almost the last person I talk to in the sales cycle, not the first.
I already know more about the product than the salesman who's going to turn up to sell it to me most of the time. Yeah. I've already researched it. I potentially might have read the manuals. I've looked at it. I will talk to people. Really, a lot of time, all I want from a salesman is a price.
And I don't actually want someone to come on site to give me a price. I'd be much happier ringing up a person in just to send me a quote or download the price list from the website, to be honest.
And a good pre-sales person, from a vendor is worth its weight in gold. I've worked with some very good pre-sales people who are very, very honest. And I'll just turn around and say, you really don't want to touch that product. And you'll see the salesman pale.
Yeah.
What do you mean? No, it's not going to do what they want to do.
Yeah, everything has a use case. And if this isn't the use case, be honest, because you're just going to walk into a world of hurt. And I'm going to hate you. And I'm going to tell everybody about it, most likely.
I mean, I've had loan hardware, which we've never turned on the grounds that I knew it didn't do what we wanted to do, but the salesman was targeted on getting something on the floor. Oh, yeah, it's shit on the floor. We'll leave it in a box.
And we'll send it back in a few weeks.
Yeah. Or sometimes not send it back at all because they've forgotten about it.
I've never done that.
No, it doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen. No.
But yeah, it would be a better model if we didn't have to go through that process. But there was something we were thinking around that, wasn't it? There, you know, reducing the number of salespeople.
I was telling you the story about a company. I can't mention the name of the company, but they were having financial difficulties. So their initial reaction. So what the CEO did, which was something quite unique, was he sacked all of his salespeople, but replaced them with engineers. So instead of having, I think it was 20 salespeople, he put 10 more engineers on to replace the salespeople. Same salaries, roughly more or less, and his sales doubled in 6 months because customers were just getting their questions answered. He would, instead of sending a salesperson out to, you know, qualify the opportunity and get it foot into the funnel, they just send an engineer out to answer customers' questions. And the customer was just placing orders because the questions were being answered faster.
And clearly the product must have been good enough.
The product was pretty good, actually. Is pretty good. I think it's going to be. And they have a powerful proposition, but it was a very technical heavy sell. And it's one of those situations when you've got a technology sell and you're sitting there in front of the salesperson and you can see the words coming out of his mouth and you can, and the eyes are going like, you know this guy's got no idea. And it's just his job to enter something into Salesforce.com when he's finished. And you're going like, why am I wasting my time talking? In fact, I'm not even going to bother. You know, I just get really annoyed by that these days. I just feel like my life's being wasted by pointless sales activities that don't add any value to me or the vendor.
Let's hope that
or the reseller.
So let's hope that we have some less or some more positive sales activities later on when we invite our vendors along. That's the sort of positive sales message
right, yes.
a vendor can make, can't they?
The credit card with a vendor attached is always a valuable activity, I think.
Definitely. But there's no reason for actually the pre-sales engineer.
Yeah, it could be.
Could be the pre-sales. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a salesperson. Could be a...
Which you can have a sensible conversation with as well.
That'd be far more successful, in all honesty.
And then they have a sales support person who's there to go run around, collect your discount levels and actually enter your prospects.
Follow up where the order's gone, why it's running late. And then they get on the phone. Before the order starts to run late, they ring you up and say, there's something wrong with your order. I'm working on it. So even if it does come 2 weeks late, you don't feel like you want to throttle the vendor because you know it's 2 weeks late.
Whereas the poor pre-sales guy at the moment, not only is expected to know his product set, most of the time he's the one who's trying to negotiate the Byzantine processes within any organisation.
Yeah.
While the salesman's swanning off, spending his commission, which he hasn't got yet.
Which he hasn't earned either. Like, all he's done is say, I'll take your purchase order.
Yeah.
You know? So the most valuable thing a salesperson does is negotiate with the purchasing department.
Yeah. That's great, because I don't have to talk to them either at that point. Yeah, that really helps.
Quite honestly, that's a very valuable use of a salesperson.
Yeah.
Great. Well, we've got an answer for what we should do with salespeople.
Yeah.
Point them at the direction of the purchasing department.
Yeah, but I think the world's changing, and I don't think we need them, right?
I think we're being facetious to some extent,
yeah.
You know, but it's true that there is less of a need, definitely.
Yeah, in the old days we needed a salesperson to, you know, draw resources down, but with technology replaces that need. Internet, if you want to gather info... The story I often tell is it's like cars, right? In the 1950s, you would go to each car dealership and test drive the model that you wanted, and then you would pick one, and then you would buy it. So the car dealer was very, very important in the buying process. But I read an article a year or so ago, and it said that when it comes to buying cars, by the time you walk onto the car dealer's lot to buy the car, you already know what car you're going to buy, and really, you're just trying to decide whether you want the mag wheels and the metallic paint job, and how much you're going to just there to haggle a deal, right? It's not like you go to the car dealer to...
Yeah.
No, or you've picked two or three, you've got your favourite that you know you're definitely going to go for,
yep.
And you're almost going to the other ones just to justify the original.
That's
you know, the original one, to say, well, at least I did do my research, at least I did try a few places.
Yes, that's right. But that's why we have car advertising in the cinema.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. And that is far more... That constant brand recognition, constant promotional activity is what drives car sales, not the car dealership anymore. And this is why I think the reseller model is under threat.
Well, it's like that across the board, though, isn't it, Greg? Mm-hmm. I mean, now you do all your research online.
Mm-hmm.
If you're buying, say you're buying a new camera, you research online, you know which camera you want, but then you'll go down to your local camera shop just to make sure it feels right.
Yeah.
Then you go back and you'll look
buy
for best,
from Amazon.
Best price online.
Amazon or eBay, most likely. Yeah. I just wonder how that's going to play out. Like, if the... Do we really depend on resellers, do you think? I don't think they're relevant to your business because you're at the very large end of the scale.
Although, at the moment, we're beginning to talk more to resellers, but that may be because vendors are pushing us down the channel model.
Yeah.
If you take IBM are pushing much, much more down the channel model because they don't, obviously, for some reason, don't want to employ salesmen.
Well, that's because they have struggling financially, so the best way is to cut staff.
Yeah.
But... The resellers don't have the margin. Like in networking, if you're a Cisco reseller, you're operating at less than 10% gross margin. Not uncommon to sell the hardware, you know, under 8% margin. It's not viable to continue that business for much longer.
Yeah, there's no value you can add for that sort of margin. You can't do it. What else can you do other than use the guy shipping?
You can drop ship it.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no room for you to even provide pre-sales.
No.
Resources.
No, which makes it really difficult. And then what's the point?
And I'm not sure that resellers are, you know, we were talking about how do you train people? How much, if you're a reseller and you've got, you know, a team of engineers, that's a fixed cost. And you can't really scale that up and scale that down as the, so the thing about selling a product is if you buy it and then you sell it, you know exactly how much you're going to make. And if you're not selling it, you're not buying it. So it costs you nothing but the salesperson, right? But if you've got 20 engineers in storage, network and server, you can't scale them down next week. Because you haven't got any orders coming, you still have a fixed cost.
And it's even worse for a lot of resellers. I mean, I've worked on a reseller before, and they have to maintain a certain number of certifications to be even able to sell the product. So they get to a stage where actually they can't lay off the engineers. If they start laying off engineers, they won't have enough certifications, so they won't be able to sell anything.
Yeah.
It's a hard life being a reseller.
It's a really difficult one, right? And then So then they start skimping on training,
yeah.
Right, and just do the bare minimum for certifications, and then they send them out to site, and then I realise that they're all idiots, and then, you know, I start to think like they don't know what they're doing, or they haven't got the skills, or haven't made the transition to the next generation of technology, and you look at them going, why did I even hire you? You know, and then you think never think to go back to that reseller again. I just wonder if that's pervasive.
Do you? It's a difficult, they're in a very difficult position, I think, very yes. difficult. And it's the same with the storage side of things, I think, as well. Very difficult.
I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not sure resellers survive. I mean, do we really just end up, you know, going to Amazon and buying our enterprise IT needs?
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Because, you know, if you buy the wrong camera, you know, you might be able to take it back.
Yep.
There might be a returns policy. You might be able to sell it on eBay for slightly less than you bought it for, and certain things have got more value.
So does software-defined storage and software-defined networking fix those issues?
Well,
does it make it easier to operate it where you don't need magicians and priestly outfits with, you know, magic wands that do stuff?
Well, you know, from a hardware perspective, if that hardware could be used by lots of different software products, then your commitment to the hardware is, I guess, pretty even. You know, you're always going to buy something for that
yep.
bit. You could look at it and say that bit's done. But software licenses aren't going to let you have that flexibility of turning around and going, oh, do you know what? I didn't want that. I'm going to get... Because the vendors have got a great tie-in with the hardware, so they know you're going to buy it, you're going to keep it for 3 years, potentially, say, 4 years, potentially. They know that in the storage industry, at least. The chances are, on that third/fourth year, you won't really have thought about how you'll get off that box because you know it's going to be hard.
Yep.
So you might take an extra year's maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, easy money for doing not a lot. And then there's a refresh cycle, which they'll make
you pay
for.
So in software-defined networking, that changes, though, right? Because software-defined networking, like software-defined storage, is years away. 2015,
yeah.
You know, 18, 17, something like that. It's not. But if you're running these overlay networks over the top, you can actually start just pulling things in and out without having massive pain like you used to.
Well, so you could do that with the software-defined storage side of things,
yeah.
but that means that that license needs to be reasonably flexible. So if you buy a 100-terabyte license for a particular software platform, is that something you're going to invest in for the next 3 years? Or do you want the flexibility to say, you know, I'll return some of that licensing if I don't use it?
Yep.
And then the vendors aren't going to like that. They're not going to want you to do that. So flexibility... Yeah,
especially when their current business model is built on this capital-intensive...
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you look at... I was talking about this about, you know, Cisco's used to selling these big heavy switches that come in, you know, $1 million for a chassis pair, and then it takes 10 years for you to use all the capacity in those switches. But in the meantime, Cisco's got that revenue in year one.
Yep.
But software licensing means that $1 million might be spread out over 10 years. So they've got this big revenue hole that they have to recover from that's going to last 3 to 5 years while we move to these, you know, they'll probably over time the software licensing revenue will recover, but for the short term, they have a revenue drop at least for the short term.
Yeah,
maybe for the longer term.
And I'm wondering how they'll structure the larger vendors, how they'll structure the licenses. How will they sell software compared to how they were used to and how they knew how to sell hardware? They've got a real issue with that.
It's what we're struggling with. You can all the sales guys I talk to have this issue. They're talking about, well, how do we move to this? That's why I wrote a blog post, Death of a Salesman, or Death of a Storage Salesman. Mm. It's about that. These things are changing rapidly. But I mean, Ben.
But what about you when buying software licensing? Do you think you're getting, like, when you go and buy a big ass switch, you know, lots of ports, and you can count them up, and you can say it's, you know, $500 a port or $100 a port, whatever it is. You knew what you were getting, right? But now, if you suddenly get a software license for $5 million, you're looking at it going, well, that was real value. Do you get that?
Yeah, we do get that, and we also get that from people who don't really understand the value because. Real things have value. Bits of paper with a software license appear not to have value.
Yeah.
So there is almost an expectation that the vendor can slash his price down to 50p.
Yep.
Because actually all he shipped was a bit of paper.
With a key on it.
With a key on it. Now, I'm big enough and grown up enough to realise that actually that vendor may well have actually sunk a lot of cost into producing that license.
Mm.
There are plenty of people who don't seem to get that.
But increasingly they're not actually investing in stuff, right? So increasingly they're not... So they're taking open source projects, adding 10% more, you know, enamel paint over the top with some metallic flex inside of it, and then trying to build what they used to do for a holding storage array. I mean, products like Ceph, which are completely open source distributed storage engines, you know, albeit not very good yet, but showing some signs of over time maybe getting to where they need to be, But if they sit there and put, you know, some little horns on it and chrome levers and some bits and pieces and then try and sell that for the price of an array, that's a bit of it.
Yeah, you're sort of also hitting another sort of bugbear of mine at the moment. Mm. Is actually looking at the number of people shipping open source products. And then what I want to know is, okay, fine, I understand that you want to supply your support model and that's what I'm paying for. But I want to see your commitment to that open source community. I want to see that you're not just riding on the back of the community. So how many developers have you got committing? Or what are you doing? What are you giving back?
Yeah. What are you doing to help feed that ecosystem? Because you won't be able to support that if you're not feeding. That's one of the things that Red Hat does well, is they actually go in and commit resources, engineers, people into the system to make sure that the product survives year on year. They're not just extracting it.
Right. So when I hear somebody say, our product's based on top of CentOS, and basically you're trying to sell me CentOS, you get a bit upset, really. I think that's not right.
Yeah.
You're actually not only that, you're taking somebody else's work, so you're taking Red Hat's work, a massive amount of it. You're not paying them any licensing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're using the free version.
Mind you, Red Hat took CentOS back in-house.
Yeah.
They bought the team in and... Mm. Now they're still producing CentOS as a thing, but
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a real issue there. You know, if you look at how the software stuff's going to go. You talked about the idea of the licensing charge. Why can't they just drop their costs down to and I guess you could look at other industries like music, where people have thought the same thing. You know, if I can just copy this music, why should I have to pay full price for a copy of that music?
I don't have a problem with paying fair price, but what I do have a problem with is what the music industry wanted to, you know, they'd been selling CDs for $10 a CD. And when we got to iTunes and digital music, they wanted to increase it to $15 a CD.
Yeah, they did. They had one other problem, and that was when you were buying that CD, that was a full CD.
Yes.
You might have two or three tracks that were actually any good, and the rest were just junk.
Yes.
But they were bundling three good tracks with ten terrible ones and still charging you the $10.
But there's a whole bunch of issues. This is what I'm saying, but that trend was they didn't just want to charge you what you used to get for the...
They wanted to charge you a premium
and still do. Still trying to, you know, say, oh, digital music, you should pay more because we should be able to increase the price every year.
I think what it dawned on them was that people would only buy the decent quality tracks, so they had to put the price up per track because otherwise they realized nobody would buy the stuff that wasn't any good.
But that was going to happen anyway.
It was going to happen, but, you know...
I heard that somebody's now... It now only takes 40,000 sales to make a number one in the US.
Yeah, actually, in the UK it's about 30,000, I think. Yeah. It doesn't take much at all. You don't get much from it. The guy who actually does it makes hardly anything because I think they get... Is it less than about 10p?
Yeah.
5 or 10 pence per...
It's insane, right?
Yeah, it is.
But the music industry is making more money than ever.
Yeah, but the music industry model's changed, hasn't it? Mm. Before, you used to tour to promote an album to make money. Now you sell an album, and then you tour, and that's where the money. So here's the thing.
If we look at that model, let's extrapolate that a little bit. If you think that everything's software, does that mean we have more software suppliers? In the same way that now we have more bands and more niches. Like, I was on Spotify the other day, and I searched up the word chill, and there was dub chill, chill jazz, chill dance, chill trance. There was all these subgenres that never existed before because they can sell enough to sustain an artist in some... So does that mean that, you know, today these massive players like EMC and Cisco and IBM and HP who dominate 60, 70, 80% of a market space, are we going to see a much more even distribution of...
So that's a fair point because... The reason all those things can exist is because the ability to distribute the music, the cost of distributing music has gone down to almost nothing.
Yes.
You know, you can put it on iTunes and let Apple take their little slice for it, even if you're not having to build the infrastructure to do that, whereas, you know...
And the cost of production's come down.
Yeah,
so... So the cost of producing music or the cost of producing software is a fraction of what it used to be because now you have Garrett and Jenkins and Maven, open source tools that allow you to produce commercial software that cost you... Whereas before, you had to have these massive tool chains that cost millions.
Yeah, and same thing with the music industry, where you'd have to press the physical CD or the record, and that would cost a lot of money. So a run would cost you a lot. You'd have to distribute to the store. Mm. If you didn't get the distribution right, some stores would sell out, some stores would have too many.
Yeah.
So, you know, you couldn't necessarily sell to people immediately.
You can never run out on iTunes
because you just download it.
Yeah.
And that's the same scenario, I guess, that the software side of things is going to get to, where it becomes incredibly cheap to deliver a software solution.
Yes.
And maybe that's why we're seeing so many more solutions coming up.
Well, I think so. I mean, I look at in networking, the rise of the white box switch has seen so many more networking startups happen because they're just producing the software that goes on those switches. Now, we're still in the emergent phase of that, but there's something similar happening in storage, right?
So I've discussed this with a number of products floating around out there which are really software products, but they're still running on hardware. And I've asked a few of the startups, well, why are you doing this? And they said, well, yet again, it comes up that actually companies won't pay for software.
They only want to buy.
They only want to buy hardware. So as consumers of products, we need to change our behaviours as well. So we stop paying for hardware we don't want, or we don't use, or reduces our flexibility, our deployment. But yeah, we are beginning to see this happen in storage. Yeah. And I think what we'll see is we're going to see things like, I know Evo Rail's not a storage product,
but
it is. But it's also that whole idea where people are going to start defining stacks, all like the open storage.
Yeah.
And you'll have that, and you'll run the personality of choice. EMC potentially moving down that way with software versions of their arrays. We'll see that. They're also doing some interesting things with their licensing models, so you can actually download their stuff and use it for non-production workloads, some of the stuff. So it's like a try-buy.
Yeah.
If you want to use it,
yep.
And you want to use it in production,
get a license key to unlock the.
You get the license key, and you can have support. If you put it in production without that license key or whatever, and it deletes all your data, well, you can probably still get support, but it's going to cost you four times as much because they've got you over a barrel.
And other vendors have done something similar, to be fair. NetApp have done that. But
so have HP.
Yeah, HP with their VSAs and things like that. So there is a lot of that out there as an example.
I just wonder how customers are going to, like, people who are used to buying a thing, you know, they buy it and then you just give it to them as a piece of software. There's that whole transition that you've got to go through that...
Yeah, and all the people who have not got used to the idea of new to it and therefore can understand the idea of buying like that and don't have to have that legacy of their history of
wonder how
of
much pressure
hardware.
That's going to create on revenue for vendor revenue. So if customers just like if I'm buying a firewall VM or an IDS VM or a you know and just buying a software license for a load balance or an F5 load balance which runs in a virtual machine. And, you know, F5 today, for example, is trying to charge me as much for a virtual machine as they do for the hardware. Same iTunes metaphor, right? And I'm just looking at it going, like, you can't charge me more per megabyte for a VM than I do for it. Because what I want to use is use 10 times as many VMs as I used to use. I want a completely different way of consuming it. And I don't believe that the vendors are going to go through that transition any better than we are.
Well, I think they're not understanding the whole cost of production thing.
Yeah.
The fact that it didn't cost them anything more to sell you two licenses. Yep. So the chances are if you bought 10 licenses slightly cheaper, you might end up buying more than you would have bought if you were being forced to pay full price of a VM.
Same with digital music. At $1 a track, people are buying more music overall.
Yeah.
Not less.
Yeah.
But they're not buying the entire album.
No.
But they're buying more music overall.
So therefore, the good vendors survive and sell their products and sell them en masse. The bad ones drop away because they're not something somebody wants to buy.
I mean, also, if you start... I was looking at smaller SAN switches recently. And if you buy a Cisco 48-port switch... It comes with first 16 ports enabled.
Oh, I hate... Oh.
But they all ship you the whole switch.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there thinking, hang on...
Yeah, but the price of the switch didn't get cheaper by 30-odd ports.
No.
It got... The 16 ports is the same price as what you used to get for 48 ports. Yeah?
No.
No?
No, it has got cheaper, so... Yeah. But
much?
But it's, a bit. But it's
a bit, exactly.
But not. It's like, they're shipping me enough hardware for those 48 ports.
Sucker punch. It's a sucker deal. Yeah.
Just give me all those 48 ports. And, you've already done it, otherwise I'll just keep buying these 16 ports.
So they do the same thing with their Ethernet switches. You buy a 48 port, only 24 ports enabled. But the price of the 24 ports is the same as what you used to get for 48.
Yeah.
And then what you do is they also hide the SFP license. Mm-hmm. So every time you buy the GBIC or the fiber channel, you know, the SFP, there's a hidden fee in there as well.
Yeah.
So if you actually price out the price of a 48-port switch with the 24-port extra licenses and the 48, you actually realize it's five times what you used to pay 3 years ago. Nice deal from the big vendors to really, like, catch you. But, of course, what do we buy in an enterprise? We buy one GBIC at a time. So nobody actually sees the full price. No. And that's where this again comes back to this architecture, not enough people on the ground to see the full value.
To build a model that actually models what you're intending to purchase and how it could work in different ways. Yeah.
Yeah, same sort of thing.
So the market's broken.
Well, we know that. And that's what the transition is about too. We recognise that the market. Customers are saying we demand better solutions, better hardware, better capabilities, and we're not getting them right. So that SDN, for example, is being driven by customers. Software-defined storage is not being driven by vendors. Customers are beating the big, you know, the incumbent vendors over the head and saying, if you don't give it, we're going somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's not a vendor-led thing in either industry, surely. No. I don't see.
No, otherwise we wouldn't have seen so many definitions for software-defined storage.
Yes.
Because all the vendors suddenly think, oh, well, that's what everybody wants. That my product must fit that, so let's find a way to describe it.
That's a really good point. Maybe the confusion around... Because SDN's got exactly the same issue. And I get people saying to me and emailing me and Twittering at me, SDN means nothing. It's just this massive thing. But if the customers are defining it, well, every one of us has a different use case.
Yeah.
Although we all take the same headache tablet, right? So the thing is... Everybody thinks SDN is different for them, although everybody's going to buy exactly the same solution for SDN. It's all going to be flow managed, central controllers, blah, blah, blah. But maybe that's the thing, is that customers are actually defining SDN, not the vendors, because the vendors just aren't ready for SDX.
Yeah, I think with the storage side of things, we'll see certain vendors succeeding because the features that are really actually real within SDS will be the ones that people will choose to buy. So they'll buy things
and
like...
And the vendors don't know what we want.
Well, they don't
understand it well enough to...
No, but it'll come because the vendors who give the features that are the ones we want to buy will succeed and the ones that don't won't. So by implication, you know, we'll find out what the features are that people want simply by the companies that succeed.
But that only happens after.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So that's the thing is that, you know, we live in a market today where the products that we want are the only ones that are left because we have a decade of stagnation.
Yeah. But I guess that's probably the same in every market that exists.
So this comes back to this story. Technology is the trend for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
The companies that survive will be the ones that have technology because in a time of change, technology leadership...
Engineer-led, founder-led companies will be the ones which will actually drive things forward and they'll do very well. Those companies which are being led by salesmen and accountants may struggle.
Will struggle. I'm certain of that. I mean, you still have to do... You know, even a company that's technology-led still needs to have... financial diligence and focus on the bottom line, blah, blah, blah. But it's being led by technology and stuff in the future, right?
Yeah, technical excellence is what we're looking for. Or good enough technical excellence.
Yeah.
That's not a contradiction.
I actually don't want world's best technology. I just want technology that works.
Yeah.
And reliability remains my biggest bugbear. Mm. I need new technology, but it needs to be reliable and stable. They're the things that are really important to me. I don't want to buy a software-defined... that's unreliable and buggy and crashes constantly. That to me is a single... I'd rather have slower pace of innovation than an unreliable product.
And I'd want something that just simply fits the requirements of what I want to buy.
Good.
You know, I make sure you outline what your requirements are clearly, but then go out and choose something that fits that and actually delivers to it. Don't buy something that does 50% of it and some other clever stuff that you never wanted in the first place.
Yeah. Don't buy everything just because you think you might want it. Yeah. Just buy what you need. You can always get something else tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sure. All right. Do we still hate each other?
No, we don't really hate you, Greg.
No.
Well, not for being a network admin anyway.
We're all going to be out of business anyway because we won't be doing network admin. We'll be doing software-defined admin.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't stop having a go at each other. We should just continue with that because that makes perfect sense.
It's much more fun.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're all going to be software-defined admins, is that...
Yeah.
Have we just started a new software-defined...
Software-defined admins. Oh, well, we can replace the admin because everybody talks about the admin.
Yeah.
So now we're the SD admin.
SD admin. SD admin network, SD admin storage, SD admin virtual.
Yeah.
I like it.
Perfect.
Thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on Twitter as @etherealmind. Martin, where can people find you?
www.storagebod.com or on the register.
All right. That's storagebod.com. Chris?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter @ChrisMEvans or architecting.it.
And as always, you can leave feedback on today's show by visiting the website and leaving comments on today's show. Follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter as @PacketPushers. You can send us email, send us love, abuse, and general support because we get all of those things and appreciate every single one. Send email to packetpushers@gmail.com. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.